Alex Stell from Imperial College, who's gonna talk about localizing brain worlds in infinite spaces.
Okay, thank you. Thanks very much. So it's a pleasure to be here at the Perimeter Institute, a place I've known about for a while, but this is my first visit here. I seem to have gotten here just as your spring started, so for whatever. It's Canadian spring, not too dissimilar from an English spring, as a matter of fact. I'm gonna tell you about a resolution of a problem I think that's been around for quite a long time, which is how to actually make a brain world construction where you get a localization of gravity in the lower dimension. This is in fact work still in preparation, but we're getting near to writing a paper on it. So I want to tell you where we've gotten to. So I'll begin with a bit of introduction about what the problem is. The idea of trying to formulate cosmology on a brain embedded in some higher dimensional space-time, I think, goes back to Rubikoff and Shaposhnikov, or perhaps earlier. That's the first paper that I know about. And it was the ideas were then developed a little bit more in the context of supergravity constructions. In particular, if you dimensionally reduce heterotic string theory down to 5 space-time dimensions via a reduction on a Calabi-Yau, that's Ricci-flat manifold, you end up with a theory that we called heterotic M theory, which is a 5-dimensional theory. And of course, in reducing on the Calabi-Yau, you turn also on fluxes. And this gives rise to a certain potential structure for scalar fields arising out of the Kaluza-Klein reduction, which has interesting solutions. One can start at this 5-dimensional theory, which has this scalar potential, and look for solutions analogous to the Horsava-Witten construction that takes you from 11 to 10. So this gives you a sandwich universe with 2 end brains, in this case 4-dimensional end brains, and we could live perhaps on one of them, with the gravity fields in the middle, the 5-dimensional bulk, but non-gravitational fields constrained to the 4-dimensional end brains, sandwiches. Now, when you make this sort of reduction on a Ricci-flat space, you give rise to a scale dependence as you go through the 5th dimension, which is linear in distance. That general idea was then extended by the first of the Randall and Sundrum papers, who didn't work really with supergravity solutions. But what they did is they simply took patches of 5-dimensional anti-de Sitter space and glued them together. They also ended up with a two brain construction in the first of the Randall Sundrum papers. The interest of this for them and in subsequent papers was an exponential scale dependence that you have as you go through the 5th dimension. They didn't, in those papers, actually show the link to supergravity theories, but one can understand this Randall Sundrum 1 construction as a limit of a certain 3-brain solution. That really is genuinely a brain solution of type 2b supergravity, which is then reduced on a 5-sphere. Now, the key difference with respect to the heterotic M-theory construction, which reduced on Calabi-Yau, is Calabi-Yau is Ricci-flat, the 5-sphere has non-vanishing Ricci scalar. And this difference is what gives rise to the exponential scale dependence in the 5-dimensional bulk.
What's the limit you're referring to?
It's a kind of a Penrosian limit to basically what the limit is, one in which the near horizon structure of the three-brain solution in type 2b has an ADS5 cross S5 structure. So you take a limit in which that portion of the space-time expands out and covers the whole space-time. So it's a parametric limit of the three-brain solution of type 2b. Okay, so those are sort of attempts to to sort of embed the Randall-Sundrum picture into a supergravity solution. Now, it was also of interest, obviously, to try to formulate a brain world in an infinite transverse space. And the next Randall-Sundrum paper, Randall-Sundrum 2, did this again by patching together sections of anti-de Sitter 5 space, parity reflected sections, with a Minkowski space join in the middle. And because this is just gluing together two sections, actually there's a discontinuity there, gives rise to, in the Einstein equations, gives rise to a delta function on the right-hand side, which can be viewed as a as a kind of additional potential for the theory. There's an effective Schrödinger problem for the transverse behavior of the solution, where I've generalized it here to sort of show you the delta function in the middle. And this has the effect of concentrating gravity in the four-dimensional subspace. So this is the basic idea of localization. Of course, here it was achieved just by patching together sections of anti-de Sitter 5. Okay, so this construction was criticized on a number of grounds, however. One is that it wasn't really a solution within an infinite transverse space, because in anti-de Sitter space, you can get to the boundary of anti-de Sitter space in a finite affine parameter if you travel along a time-like or light-like geodesic. Another complaint was that this obtaining a flat four-dimensional brain surface at the joint amounted to a certain amount of fine-tuning. Incidentally, that fine-tuning corresponds with preserving supersymmetry in the solution. But this was another complaint about it. Another difficulty was really that it isn't a supergravity construction. It's really just joining together sections. Now, as actually we showed in another paper, you can view this again, is your question, is a dimensionally reduced limit of the near horizon geometry of the type 2B3 brains with a round S5 as a reduction space. But watch it. If you're going to have this reflected solution of ADS5 in five dimensions, you're basically making a parity flip from one ADS5 segment to another. And if you want to do this within type 2B supergravity, you have to figure out what this parity flip really is. Now, type 2B doesn't have parity as a symmetry. It's a chiral theory. What it has are SO19 transformations in 10 dimensions. But S, they're unit modular. So all you have to play with are determinant lambda equals 1 symmetries in 10 dimensions. So what that means is you're not actually reducing on a single 5-sphere. What you're reducing is on half of the space in a 5-sphere, in another half of the space on a 5-sphere with an orientation reversing transformation in the 5-sphere. And when you glue these two 5-spheres together, you don't see this from the lower 5-dimensional point of view, but when you look at it from the 10-dimensional point of view, you actually get a nasty singularity at the join of the 5-sphere to 5-sphere. This subsequently has the consequence of breaking supersymmetry. And in any case, this singularity isn't a natural object. It's really just a cobbling together of segments. Okay, so those are problems with the Randall-Sundrum solution, trying to embed it into supergravity theory. Now, there was another attempt by Karsh and Randall, which simply took ADS5 and joined together ADS4 slices, basically taking ADS5, again, carving out segment and joining together ADS4 slices together. This can be done either with a flat join or with a join at an ADS4. The warp factor near the four-dimensional brain will be close to that of a Minkowski space if you choose an appropriately small ADS4 cosmological constant. So this can be a model for a system with a massive bound state graviton that gives an approximation to four-dimensional gravity. Okay, but still, it's really just carving up together spaces and gluing them together. It's not a natural object from the point of view of string or supergravity theory. So there was a paper by Kostas Bakas and John Estes that tried to look at this in more general terms, and first of all, to see if it is possible to make a genuine string or supergravity construction and obtain the localization in a supergravity construction. And they trace the difficulty in doing this to the behavior of the warp factor. The warp factor, of course, conformal factor that sits out in front of the four-dimensional submetric within the overall 10-dimensional metric. I use Einstein frame for these discussions. So in the Karsh-Randall splice model, by the gluing together of these ADS4 segments, you obtain a peak in the warp factor at the join because you're gluing together these segments. Now, that, in fact, is the cause of the localization. So if you incorporate that peaked warp factor into the effective Schrödinger problem for the transverse part of the wave function, what you find, again, is something similar to the earlier Randall-Sundrum paper with a volcano potential. So this is for a de Sitter sign solution, again with a volcano potential, that causes the binding of gravity to the four-dimensional subspace. Okay, well, can you do this now without just cobbling together segments of anti-de Sitter spaces? Can you actually do it by some natural string or supergravity construction? So this is what Bacchus and Estes tried to do, and they ran into a problem. They considered a family of solutions known as a Janus family of solutions, where you have the dilaton of the 10-dimensional type 2a or type 2b string theory is allowed to have a discontinuous jump, right? So this looked like a family of candidate solutions that you could try to use to make something like the Karshen-Rendel construction. But what they found in the warp factor is a family of warp factors that look like this. They're nice and smooth. They don't have this peak at the join. And in fact, that gives rise to a system where the gravity on the lower dimensional subspace basically spreads out into the higher dimension. It is not concentrated on the higher dimension. There's no binding of gravity to the lower dimensional subspace. So these systems are a little bit like trying to dimensionally reduce on this plane within three dimensions. I can declare that I want interesting solutions, say, of the Laplace equation on this plane, and there are some. It's actually a consistent truncation of the three-dimensional Laplace. But there's nothing that says I can't, by infinitesimal small deformations, excite the extra dimension. So if you don't have this binding of the system to the lower dimension, you haven't really achieved a localization. So Bacchus and Estes argued that this sort of difficulty would be generic for string or supergravity solutions where the asymptotic geometry of the solutions you get far away from the brain is maximally symmetric. Yeah?
I only worried about localizing gravitons or also fermions.
Like, there'll be a super multiplet. Everybody be localized together within the gravity super multiplet.
So you hope that...
No. So there's a point of view about the rest of the world, for example, in the Randall-Sundrum 1 model or in our earlier model based upon the heterotic M theory, where stuff that lives on the brains can be only on the brains. For example, in 10 dimensions heterotic theory, you have the Yang-Mills fields exist only on the brain. So I'm not really talking about that. That is a natural localization by construction. The question is whether you can get gravity also to localize on the brains. Right? So it's gravity that's the hard job. If you have the transverse oscillations of the brain are naturally associated to the brain alone. Right? So they're brain zero modes, the Goldstone modes for the broken Poincaré symmetries of the brain that naturally associated to the brain alone. But gravity is really belonging to the whole space. And the question is whether it concentrates at the locations of the brain so it has effectively a lower dimensional behavior or not. That's the key question here. So in the Randall-Sundrum construction and the Karsh-Randall constructions, by cobbling together spaces, they achieved it with this binding. But the question is, can you actually do it by a real supergravity construction that doesn't have this artificial cobbling construction? Okay, so I'm going to tell you about another approach to this, which starts with a family of supergravity theories or constructions that has always been there but hasn't been particularly looked at very much. I'll come to the reason why in a moment. Back in 1984, Abdussalam and Ergin Sezgin constructed the following model of six-dimensional minimal supergravity. The minimal, that's 1, 0, chiral supergravity in six dimensions. It has a three-form in it, which in the minimal theory, three-form in six dimensions can be self-dual. And indeed, the minimal theory has a self-dual three-form field strength. Now, by including also a tensor multiplet, a two-form tensor multiplet, which also has a three-form self-dual gauge field strength, you can make the net theory have a G mu nu rho without the self-duality constraint. You basically supply the anti-self-dual part from the tensor multiplet. And here is what and you also couple it to a six-dimensional super Maxwell multiplet. And here's the bosonic part of that theory. So it has the Einstein Hilbert action, it has the kinetic term for the vectors, the three-form scalar field. And note, this last term is what I really want to focus on for the scalar. It has a potential, it's an exponential potential, but note the sign. This is what is unusual in a supergravity construction. Of course, this is kinetic minus potential in a Lagrangian. This potential is positive. That's very unusual. You don't generally see positive potentials in supergravity constructions. Negative potentials give rise to anti-de Sitter spaces all over the place, but not positive potentials. This potential has arisen because there's a gauging of the R symmetry, U1 R symmetry of the six-dimensional theory. And this was what made this model stand out. Now, for a while, this is sort of the only model that had this structure with a positive potential in it. Actually, what we've come to see later on is that it belongs to a family. You can't really see the family it belongs to when you're talking about U1. You don't know the difference between U1 and R, the line, you know, the R meaning the real line group. But actually, this is more R, what we have here, because it's a model with a non-compact gauge symmetry. Now, in fact, it can be generalized. If you couple yet more vector multiples in it, you see, for example, there's a family of extensions of this, which include a sigma model for the scalars with a structure SOP, Q divided by SOP cross SOQ, with this SOP cross SOQ, of course, is linearly realized. So we can have models with non-compact gauge symmetries. And in particular, SO2,2 is an example of this. Now, before I come on to the extension to the gauge symmetries, let's just look at the solutions of this theory. So it starts with a positive potential in six dimensions. You can now try to do something that you can't normally do. You can reduce on a sphere with positive Ricci scalar. Normally, in the lower dimension, that would give rise to an anti-de Sitter space in the lower dimension. But you started with a positive potential. So the subtracting of the potential in the lower dimension that you get can subtract off basically the curvature effects of the two sphere, ending up with Minkowski space in the lower dimension. So here is a solution of that theory. It's flat in the lower four dimensions. It has a two-sphere section with radius a. It has a U1 monopole turned on in the two-sphere directions. And in fact, the quantum number of the monopole has to be plus or minus 1. It corresponds, if you wish, to a half vibration of the three-sphere. Now, this is, in fact, rather local physics, because this is the sort of model that Cliff Burgess and company and Fernando Quevedo have been pursuing in their supersymmetry and large extra dimensions constructions. The attractiveness of this is the natural cancellation of the cosmological potential and giving rise to four-dimensional flat space. And indeed, this is that what they want to use it for is to basically dilute a cosmological constant that could arise from spontaneous symmetry breaking, TeV scale energies on the end brains of a system in six dimensions. If you have a system in six dimensions, we have some sort of four-dimensional end brains producing TeV scale energies. Instead of producing a cosmological constant in four dimensions, the effect of that could be diluted in the extra two dimensions. That's the whole, in a nutshell, is the hope of the SLED program. Now, I don't want to go into that too much. That's another whole seminar one could engage in. But I want to see whether can we do anything like this, right? but within with real sort of natural supergravity components. Okay, so as I've said, the Salam-Sezgin model naturally extends to models with SOP, Q gauge symmetries. And there was a way to obtain the Salam-Sezgin model along these lines that was found by Miriam Svetich, Gary Gibbons, and Chris Pope. This started either in 10 or 11 dimensions, in type 2A supergravity in 10 dimensions. You can reduce on the certain three-dimensional space called H22. It's a hyperbolic space, which is not a homogeneous space, but it is cohomogeneity 1. Basically, there's a radius, and then the subspaces at constant radius are homogeneous. They can be obtained by embedding into four-dimensional Riemannian space via this obviously SO22 invariant construction, plus plus minus minus, or the square is equal to 1. That's clearly SO22 invariant, However, the embedding space has SO4 symmetry. So actually, the isometries that you're going to get on this space are the intersection of SO22 with SO4, which is just SO2 cross SO2. This, again, is the cohomogeneity 1. It's not maximally symmetric space in three dimensions, but it has this cohomogeneity 1 structure. And here is the explicit form of the three-dimensional metric. Now, this space admits, nonetheless, a natural SO22 group action. And the resulting theory that you're going to get, 10 minus 3 is 7. You'll have a 7-dimensional supergravity theory, which has maximal supersymmetry and a gauged SO2, 2 symmetry, which is linearly realized on SO2 cross SO2. Now, this fits nicely into the general scheme of the extended Salam-Sezgin gauge models. Now, you might ask me, how can one have a gauged non-compact symmetry without introducing ghosts? Well, that's the magic of doing things with all the scalars that occur in these dimensional reductions. I'm not going to go into this in detail, but I just want to point out to you, here's the bosonic Lagrangian of the SO22 theory. If you look at the way the scalar fields here, the pi are basically the scalar field binds describing, we started out with 16 scalar fields a priori, minus the various gauge degrees of freedom, minus one for the determinant condition. So there are 9 scalars that are left after all. And there's a sort of composite group structure that you can see in these covariant derivatives. The A are the vectors that are gauging the SO22. And these indices A bar and B bar are the ones that correspond to the local gauge symmetry. Now, if the local gauge symmetry preserves a metric eta, which is equal to delta A bar B bar, then you're back to a well-known supergravity construction by Nastase, Vamanen, and von Nievenhausen, which has a standard SO4 symmetry. On the other hand, if eta AB is the diagonal plus plus minus minus metric, then you have a gauged SO22 symmetry. Note, however, that as far as the kinetic terms are concerned, these alpha and beta indices here, which are the ones that really the space-time indices, are raised and lowered with ordinary Kronecker deltas on the scalar. So they never give rise to negative kinetic energy fields. The gauging of the non-compact symmetry is always achieved by a combination of gauge fields and these non-linearly transforming scalar fields that occur in the model. Okay, so this is the family of theories. The question is, can one obtain this in some acceptable way from a reduction? Well, before we come to the reduction question, let's just note that once you've got this theory in 7 dimensions, you can further truncate it to minimal supergravity in 7 dimensions. It started actually with n equals 2 supergravity in 7 dimensions, which is 32 supercharges. You can truncate it to the minimal symmetry in 16 supercharges just by throwing away part of the theory. Then, if you reduce from 7 to 6 on, this is a Harjava-Witten type construction, S1 over Z2, you obtain a chiral theory in 6 dimensions, which is exactly the Salam-Sezgin theory. So this actually is a larger theory with more symmetry, but you can throw away parts of it and you find the Salam-Sezgin theory living in the midst of it. Okay, so this is a generalization of the Salam-Sezgin model with this interesting gauged non-compact symmetry. Now, if you stick with the 1, 0 theory in 6 dimensions, you find at the quantum level it has an anomaly. And what to do with that if you want to try to make sensible physics out of this? This, of course, is important for the supersymmetry and large extra dimension people. You need to somehow deal with that anomaly. So there is a way to do that by, instead of just reducing on S1 over Z2, you again can make a Harjava-Witten construction going from 7 to 6, populating the end brains now with extra matter that arises precisely in order to cancel the anomaly by anomaly inflow. Again, that's a whole seminar I could tell you about, but let me just say that there is a way to get an anomaly-free theory of this general sort. That, however, isn't really my main topic here today. I want to come to the question of this reduction on H22, is it really what I want to call a localization? The problem, again, is just the one of trying to reduce, for example, on a plane embedded in 3 dimensions. I can do it. It's a mathematically consistent reduction, but it's not a natural reduction. You blow on it and a piece of paper will fly off because there's nothing binding it to the lower dimensional space. The chief problem in the point of view of the Kaluza-Klein spectrum is that if you look at the spectrum, you'll find that there's a continuum of Kaluza-Klein modes that come right down, that can come right down to the states that you are trying to retain. There's no mass gap. The key to localization would be the existence of a mass gap. Another way of seeing this problem is if you look from the higher dimensional point of view at the wave function, that's the total structure of a solution, say a fluctuating solution about this H22 Salam-Sezgin background, you'll find that the transverse part, the part perpendicular in the infinite transverse dimensions, includes, it's basically constant in case, and it's not normalizable. You have a clear metric in the higher dimensional space, and unlike for compactifications, where it's a compact space, so obviously wave functions are normalizable. If you integrate over a compact space, there's no problem. In an infinite transverse space, you run into this difficulty that the wave functions will be not non-normalizable.
Sorry, I don't really understand the philosophy of that. So would you make the same objection to Minkowski space?
A two-dimensional Minkowski space embedded in a four-dimensional Minkowski space, yes. There's nothing to limit you, to restrict you to the two-dimensional Minkowski space.
I mean, specifically, what is this wave function you're talking about?
We want to have solutions in the full higher dimensional theory that look like they are solutions to the lower dimensional theory. Right? Now, in a lower dimensional theory, if I have this eraser, its wave function is, it doesn't go out to infinity, doesn't go beyond the Canadian border. The wave function stops here, right? So we make physical constructions with wave functions that are, of course, you have the whole issue for continuum states that you have to, but the delta function normalize them and so forth and apply appropriate boundary. But we're talking about a reduction where the transverse behavior is going to be basically fixed once and for all. And if it's just constant, it's not going to be normalizable. So for these reducing solutions of the type discussed now, it's really like just reducing on a subplane in a flat space. I can do it, and it is a mathematically consistent reduction, but it is not really a binding to the lower dimensional space. So this normalizability issue and the absence of a mass gap are two sides of the same problem.
Can I ask one other thing before you use it? This Minkowski cross a two-sphere solution, is it stable to perturbation?
Yes, it's actually a very nice solution. That's why Cliff and company like it. It's first of all, that solution has an unbroken four-dimensional n equals one supersymmetry, which is also very nice from the point of view of phenomenology. Now, that's for the reduction on a round sphere, two-sphere cum monopole. Another thing that you can show is if you relax the assumptions on this compactifying space to what in North America you can call a football. In Europe, you have to say a rugby ball. That is to say, a space with conical singularities at the end. Just assume axial symmetry. Don't assume the full spherical symmetry. Nonetheless, the solution still has flat four-dimensional Minkowski space as its solution. So it's quite rugged, right? And this is the attraction. Basically, if you try to put a cosmological constant on the bounding four-dimensional brains, on these two conical singularities, that's where brain energy, positive on both sides, by the way, in this case, is going to be concentrated and could be at the TeV scale. Nonetheless, the effect of the cosmological constant is diluted into the two extra dimensions, perhaps with some small bleed over from quantum corrections that give you a small cosmological constant on the brains. But that's Cliff's program. I don't want to go into it, but that's the whole motivation, is the robustness of this cancellation mechanism. What I want to be concerned with is, can we actually make this really a sensible construction within string or supergravity theory? OK, so we want to find some sort of natural construction that achieves a localization. So the key issue is, can we get bound states? Remember the volcano potential of the Randall-Sundrum or Karsh-Randall models. We would like to achieve something like that with a natural mass gap between the bound state and the beginning of a continuum that surely is going to be there in an infinite transverse space. Can we achieve that? We would like to have a normalizable transverse space wave function with a mass gap before the onset of the continuous Kaluza-Klein spectrum. And you could think of this as somewhat analogous to physics on a metal, where you have electrons and so forth propagating on the metal, but there's a work function I guess Albert Einstein got his Nobel Prize for this, right? There's a work function in order to liberate electrons because there's a binding of that the electron system to the surface of the metal. We want something like that happening here, but for gravity. Now, a general study by Sabasaki and collaborators, and also Bakas and Estes, shows that the mass spectrum of, let's focus now just on spin 2 here, because it's a lot easier to discuss than when you talk about the lower spins, you get involved in details of fluxes and so forth. But a nice feature is that to study the spectrum of spin 2 fluctuations, the mass spectrum from the lower dimensional point of view, what you have to do is study the spectrum of the scalar Laplacian in the embedding space of the brain object. So here is a 10-dimensional scalar D'Alembertian, really, because time is now included here, 1 over square root of g, derivative square root of g, inverse g times the derivative, okay, the standard construction for scalar Laplacian. And so here in the Salam-Sezegun background, I've worked it out here, you have the 4-dimensional D'Alembertian. Okay, this is what we want to know whether we have massless or massive states for. Then these are the compact directions involving the angles and sphere and so forth, which I'm not, this we'll just treat by an ordinary Kaluza-Klein reduction because it's compact. And then we have delta KK for Kaluza-Klein, which is given here. This is the radial part of the H22 space, which is giving rise to the, in principle, to the continuous spectrum. Here's the HSS is the is the warp factor to the H to the minus 1. Okay, so that's the structure of the scalar D'Alembertian that we need to study. And so what we will do is, to handle the non-compact direction, we need to expand in eigenmodes of that Laplacian. So there will be, in principle, a certain number of discrete states, bound states, and then a continuum. So we're getting into ordinary quantum mechanics problems here. So here are the eigenvalues of delta KK. If it's delta KK of psi equal to minus lambda, then the four-dimensional, I guess this should have again been a box, because the Laplacian would be g squared lambda, will be the masses of the states in the four-dimensional subspace. And the question is whether these come continuously down to zero, which is the case that happens, for example, if you embed a plane into a higher dimensional flat space. So what is the system here? Okay, so we need to study the eigenvalue problem for this Kaluza-Klein Laplacian. And it's convenient to make a redefinition of the candidate eigenfunction by this square root of a cinch of 2 rho. After, basically, what you do by doing this is you get rid of a first derivative part of the wave equation. And you end up with this structure, which has a nice pure second derivative and a potential structure. Okay, so we have to study the eigenvalue problem of this system with this potential given here. So 2 minus 1 over tan squared 2 rho. And that potential has an asymptote at value 1 for large rho. And in that limit, the Schrodinger problem looks like this, with the lambda minus 1 occurring here. And for lambda greater than 1, you therefore have scattering state solutions. These clearly are the continuum that you anticipate. But on the other hand, in fact, you have to see what normalizability means, and you have to look at the appropriate norm in this case. It turns out for lambda less than 15/16, you can have L2 normalizable bound states. Basically, in this after this rescaling by the square root of the cinch of 2 rho, the norm basically goes like just an ordinary norm. Well, anyway, here we have given here, here's the problem. There's e to the 5 rho over 2 norm times d rho. And in order for this to be finite, we find that lambda is less than 15/16. So we have candidate bound states in this range. Okay, so already we are looking for a system that could have a mass gap.
Could you elaborate a tiny bit on what determines the appropriate norm in this setting?
Yes, I can. And that's a little bit confusing. Bakas and Estes discussed this. What you want is, it's essentially like the issue of self-adjointness, that you want to be able to integrate by parts the Laplacian from one candidate wave function to another. This means that the integral of the surface term that you get in hopping the Laplacian from a phi 1 to a phi 2, the surface term that you get there has to be finite. That contains an additional factor of basically g rho rho in addition to the 10-dimensional square root of g. Okay, so I didn't want to...
So but the point, our overarching point is to make sure that it's really a solution, a stationary point of the full higher dimensional action for the field?
Yes.
Is that what's under?
That's right. That's right. Yeah. That norm also works extremely nicely with this Schrodinger problem. okay, so we have candidate bound states, but I'm not there yet. Now, you'll notice that this potential diverges as rho goes to 0. So that rho equals 0 is a regular singular point of the Schrodinger equation. And near rho equals 0, solutions are going to have a structure given by this Frobenius expansion. You see the logarithm also is coming from the... this is the rescaled wave functions with the root rho in there from the square root of the sinh. But the unrescaled wave function has the c plus d log rho structure, which again is singular at rho equals 0. Now, this behavior does not affect the normalizability. This is behavior at the origin. Normalizability is basically a question of what happens at infinity. But it does indicate that there's a whole family of bound states, or candidate bound states, who are characterized by this ratio of c to d. So we can parameterize that by the arctangent of c over d. And in fact, there's a numerical study that shows that there's a one-to-one relationship between the value of this quantity theta and the lambda eigenvalue in this potential. Now, as I've said here, the limit of such a candidate wave function is singular as rho goes to 0. So what we need in order to really justify these wave functions is to find some way to select a bound state, hopefully corresponding to massless gravitons, and at the same time to justify this singular behavior as rho goes to 0. So what we have so far isn't quite enough. There are these attractive candidate wave functions, but we can't just say, let's live in one. You essentially have to have the theory force you to live in one. So how are we going to do that? We have to generalize the system more. Now, let me just say that there, as far as the wave function are concerned, the general wave functions for arbitrary eigenvalue lambda can't be given in terms of standard functions. Out at infinity, they look like Bessel functions for the candidate bound states, but they're some complicated form. But there is one case where you can solve it explicitly, which is the most interesting one. It's for theta equals 0. That's just the pure log part at the origin. And that corresponds to 0 eigenvalue. This is what would be the transverse wave function for massless gravitons in four dimensions. And this one, luckily, we can actually solve explicitly. Okay, so here is a graph of the Schrodinger equation potential in purple, and the potential is in orange here. As you can see, that it's asymptotes to 1, and it goes to minus infinity as you approach the origin. And what's in purple is the zero mode. Okay, so you see this zero mode. If we were allowed to live on it and say this is our home, it's concentrating you near the origin. Right, so this is starting to sound like this could really be a brain world compactification. Okay, but we're not quite there yet because we need to put something else into this structure in order to really generate this type of zero mode. Okay, so we need to add something else to the model. basically, you can see that you need to add something else because the original Salam-Sezgin background was purely smooth. There's no singularity at all. It's a regular solution. Whereas we have these candidate transverse wave functions that are singular at the origin, that's not going to happen naturally on that background, that smooth background. So there's a reason to put something else into the picture. We would like to put something else into the picture that doesn't destroy too much of the nice features of the Salam-Sezgin background. And in fact, one of the things that you can study, for example, by a probe brain analysis of putting very, very light extra brains on top of this background, is that a Noether-Schwarz 5 brain has the very nice property that it doesn't destroy any of the supersymmetry of the Salam-Sezgin background. So that sort of volunteers itself as a candidate. So we're going to look at the following structure. Here, the H22 space is, as I've said, is a hyperbolic type space. And I have to obviously scrap some coordinates here in order, some dimensions in order to sketch it. It has this S2 factor in the space-time. That's where in the transverse space. And I'm going to wrap Neuwirth-Schwarz 5 brain, or smear it, around this 2-sphere. I can only indicate a circle here because of drawing problems, right? So that's the structure we wanted. We want to have the H2-2 space with the Neuwirth-Schwarz 5 brain source smeared along the 2-sphere part of the transverse metric and see what happens there.
So you were saying something about the probe brain. You are not smearing in the probe brain.
No, in the probe brain has no back reaction, so it just happily lives on the Slomczewskin background. And in the probe brain, what you do is you look at the conditions for kappa symmetry, whether you get gamma matrix projection conditions on the supersymmetry parameter, and see whether those are compatible with the supersymmetries of the background. It happens for a Neuwirth-Schwarz 5 brain probe, it's exactly compatible. It doesn't even reduce the background supersymmetry at all.
But then you actually solve it.
We're coming to the back reaction next. So this was the hard part of the problem, right, to actually get this to the back reacted solution to work. So that's really what we've done, and that's what I want to tell you about now. So we're going to actually put a source. We had the supergravity equations with equals zero on the right-hand side so far. Now we want to put the variation of a brain action. So I'm not going to go into the full details of that analysis, but I'm going to tell you basically what happens. First of all, in order to see how this works, we have to recognize what this Slomczewskin background is that we're looking at. So here is the 10-dimensional non-singular metric written out here, again with the warp factor in front that I told you about, and it's accompanied by a two-form gauge field, or in 10 dimensions, of course, a two-form has a three-form field strength, dualizes to a seven-form field strength. This is a D of a six-form gauge potential, which would like to be the gauge potential for a five-type object. So five brains are somehow in the neighborhood of this thing, right? It's a magnetic type of solution involving the original two-form of the 10-dimensional type 2A theory, good old Neuwirth-Schwarz two-form, and, of course, the dilaton present here. So that's the starting Slomczewskin background. The x mu are the four-dimensional coordinates. Y is the fifth coordinate. This will be compactified eventually, but let's write the whole thing down for time being. We have the angle. The angle here with the angle coordinates are theta and phi, and then there's a chi coordinate, which is basically a kind of around the tip of the cigar behavior. I'm going to show you around which cigar in just a second. Now,
can I ask you a question? So when you were smearing on the S2,
yes,
the probe brain approximation, so was the smearing crucial to ensure the supersymmetry?
No, it's not.
So the SO3 isometry is not necessary.
The reason we smear is you could see their logarithms here. Anybody knows that we have to recognize some kind of intersecting brain construction here with harmonic functions on some underlying space. The underlying space is actually four-dimensional. I'll give away the clue. It's actually Iguchi-Hansen space that's hiding in the middle of all of this. That, of course, is a four-dimensional space. But we want wave functions that have logarithms in them, which are two-dimensional harmonic functions, mm-hmm. Right? So actually, what we need to do is to smear over the two-sphere part of the Iguchi-Hansen space.
See, the thing that what worries me a little bit is that so you are smearing the... you are smearing uniformly.
Yes.
So whether the smearing is stable?
Yes, it is. You see, because these are BPS solutions, I can have in the transverse space, I can have a harmonic function that's localized at a point.
Right.
I can have 2 points. I can have 15 points. I can have a whole matrix. I can take the limit, and I can actually put any profile function I want.
So that's why I was asking whether the supersymmetry is crucial.
No, its supersymmetry is crucial to make this work. Yes, that's true. Supersymmetry is crucial to make this work. Otherwise, I couldn't just decide to do this smearing in the way I want to do. I am, by the way, dropping all the angular coordinates and so forth. If you want to consider non S2 symmetric, then you're going to, then Laplacians get nastier to look at and so forth. But basically, we are truncating to the spherically symmetric subspace, but because that's a standard Kaluza-Klein problem, there's no issue with it.
Right, I understand it, but then if I start...
You always have an S-wave as the leading
right.
solution.
So in the instance, something breaks supersymmetry in my construction, then I immediately have to start worry whether your whole construction collapses, because all the NS5 brains, instead of wanting to be uniformly smeared on S2, you know, get dumped into a point.
Well, sort of depends on which scale you want to break supersymmetry. I'm talking about the high dimensions, 11 or 10 down to 7, and then the people who are breaking supersymmetry are doing it down from 6 to 4.
Yeah, I understand
right.
that we are into phenomenology discussions. With,
okay.
Yeah.
So, yeah. The thing that we're kind of happy about is that we've actually managed to make this work with the honest solution. These are honest pieces of the, you know, the what do you call it, erector set. I'm old enough to have a Lego kit. That you get that every string theorist supersymmetrist gets, you know, with it is kindergarten. You get to play with these things. These are standard objects, right? So let's try to go a little bit further with this. This is the starting solution. So the question is, all right, first of all, this solution has 8 unbroken supersymmetries, again, corresponding to solutions of the 10-dimensional Killing spinner equations. Okay, so one had to first of all find what these supersymmetries were. Here they are. They depend upon there's a constant eta satisfying these two projection conditions. That's how you break it down to 8 unbroken supersymmetries. And then there's this dependence upon the chi coordinate, which I said is going to be sort of like the circle around the tip of the cigar. Cigar is coming. Okay, so that's for the supersymmetry. Now, the key to generalizing this solution is, first of all, to recognize what you are looking at. Okay? What is it? This is some fun. There's all sorts of vibration going on in there and so forth. So what is it? Well, so first of all, we dimensionally reduced it from 10 to 9 dimensions on one of those compact coordinates. An angle is called psi. It's actually in the original, when I wrote originally down the metric, it's alpha plus beta. Okay, so psi is, you can do alpha plus beta and alpha minus beta. Alpha minus beta is basically chi. Alpha plus beta is basically psi. So we reduce to 9 dimensions on psi. And then you recognize that actually this fits into a category of constructions called brain resolutions through transgression. In order to recognize it, it's useful to pass, to, first of all, to the string frame, after which the reduction ansatz has a very simple form given here. One-step reduction gets you an additional scalar and an additional vector, the Kaluza-Klein vector from 10 to 9. And the 10-dimensional dilaton that you originally had is a combination of this scalar and another scalar called phi 1. So we choose this parameterization, which is useful for us. Then you recognize the Salam-Sezgin solution as a special 9-dimensional case of a solution involving a forebrain in 9 dimensions with a harmonic function given here. Okay, so here's the metric for this underlying transverse 4 dimensions. Okay, so a forebrain solution, 5-dimensional world volume, 4 transverse dimensions in 9 dimensions. What is it? What's the geometry of that transverse space? Well, it's given here, this dF S4 bar squared. And that's an old friend, that's Iguchi Hansen. Right? If you make a coordinate change here, the underlying 4-dimensional transverse metric just becomes this self-dual Ricci-flat Iguchi-Hansen metric with the radius A is 1 over G. So this fits into the system of brain resolution through transgression because it has a 3-form field strength. That's for the 9-dimensional 2-form gauge field. this is reduced from A2 in 10 dimensions. Obeys the following Bianchi identity. DF3, that's a 4-form, is the wedge product of 2 F2s. So we had an F2 in 10 dimensions. We get an additional one from the Kaluza-Klein reduction. Their wedge product, minus F2 wedge curly F2, is going to be the violated Bianchi identity for F3. This is the transgression structure. Okay? And here is the forebrain. So F2 and F2 curly have to be self-dual in the Iguchi-Hansen metric. Now, Iguchi-Hansen has exactly the self-dual harmonic forms to make this possible. So it's looking good. And here we have the forebrain ansatz given here. How do I get this? Oh, yeah, yes. Okay. So the dual of F3 is dA5, here A5 can be given here in terms of a sort of dualized magnetic potential. And the solution will work providing the H here, it's going to be a harmonic function that occurs here, satisfies the following equation. It's not a solution of the homogeneous Laplace equation, but it's a solution of the Laplace equation with a F curly F contraction on the right-hand side. That's the way this solution works. So triangle EH4 is the scalar Laplacian in the Iguchi-Hansen four-dimensional transverse metric. So in fact, what we have is a solution, the Salam-Sezgin starting solution is exactly a solution of this sort. Here we have F2 and curly F2. Actually, they're just opposite in sign, given here. This is the self-dual two forms. And H, therefore, has to satisfy this solution, 8g squared over cos to the fourth 2 rho. And indeed, one exactly has the hyperbolic secant, cosecant of such of 2 rho is the solution to that. So that's the original solution. But once you've seen this, it's now easy to generalize it by adding a homogeneous piece. Any solution of an inhomogeneous differential equation, you can add to it a solution of the homogeneous equation. And that's how we put the Neuwirth-Schwarz fibrain on top, right? So we go immediately from the Sech 2 rho to Sech 2 rho with the solutions of the homogeneous equation as a constant and another constant times the log times the tanh of rho. So C1 and C2 are integration constants. You can now reverse engineer this, put it back up into the original Einstein frame 10-dimensional solution, and here we have it. So this is now the generalized solution, including, in fact, a general family of Neuwirth-Schwarz fibrains. So the harmonic function has been changed this way. And, okay.
Comment on potential singularities in your Einstein frame. Oh, okay, it's here.
It's here. The whole point, we put a singularity because we wanted to put a singularity because we want to put a thing there, right? Mm-hmm. Now, in that country south of here, every school kid learns a little story about George Washington and the cherry tree, right? Chopped down the cherry tree. His father said, "Did you cut down the cherry tree?" He said, "I cannot tell a lie." And he got whooped and he eventually became president, okay? Now, the point about this is, if you tell absolutely the truth about these supergravity equations, were you ever, here with this solution on the previous slide, were you actually solving the supergravity equations? No. There's a cherry tree you should have had there. There was a source that should have been on the right-hand side, but it's a delta function source. It's only in it's in a restricted space, okay? So you're really supposed to be solving, in fact, if we look for the general eigenvalue problems here, not just the Iguchi-Hansen Laplacian equals plus lambda h. This is, in fact, what you would have had for the eigenvalue problem, ignoring these fine points about sources. But including the sources, there are Neuwirth-Schwarz fibrain sources that are supposed to be on the right-hand side, both for the static solution that I showed you and for the fluctuations. And they have to work together, and they do rather beautifully. So I'm not going to go through the details of that, but the source action on the right-hand side is a standard brain action with the right dilaton coupling and so forth and gauge field coupling. And in any case, let me just give you the answer. It works, okay?
And there is nothing funny happening with the dilaton. It doesn't blow up anywhere.
Well, the dilaton is given by the dilaton solves also its field equation. This source action is the source action for everything in the type 2A supergravity multiplet.
But if I go far away, wouldn't I get linear dilaton?
We're not telling. One of the key points of this is this spacetime is sort of asymptotically hyperbolic. All sorts of things are growing large in infinity, but it's a reasonable place to live because we're going to have normalizable wave functions. We don't want to live far out. We want to live on the subsurface.
Yeah, I understand. But my questions lead to questions whether or not I'm actually expecting a consistent supergravity truncation within the Fuller string theory. So if you're going to tell me that far away the dilaton, the string coupling is huge, right? Then that's something that we should worry about.
Let's talk about that. I'm really concerned just to try to get you a home on the prairies in four dimensions, right?
I'm happy to believe that that is a...
It's a non-compact compactification or a non-compact reduction that we're making here on purpose because we're trying to do that, right? To live in, and the key point is this is not a maximally maximally symmetric space. It's not de Sitter, anti-de Sitter, or flat, which is what everybody else tried. Its hyperbolic structure is key to allowing this localization to work. Okay? So you can decide whether there are things, aspects of that that you don't like, but the key point for me is that in four dimensions, there is a concentration on the lower dimensional subspace. Actually, it's a six-dimensional subspace, but two of them can be ordinary compact directions, so you get to four in a natural way. Okay, so the modified function in this problem, if you... modified function H, in fact, has factorizes out for the zero. If you look at lambda equals zero, this term is irrelevant. The H function, which now is different from what it was for Salam-Sezgin, factorizes out, and in fact, the zero mode turns out to be exactly the same as in the original Salam-Sezgin ground state solution. It's not changed. What you have learned about the candidate zero mode is in fact the integration constants. You cannot have the C1 part, the constant part. That will violate the coupling to the Noether-Schwarz fibrain on the right. It's only the log tanh that works. Okay, and in fact, that is in agreement with the normalizability issue of this wave function. Okay, supersymmetry remains unchanged. The modified solution still has 8 unbroken supersymmetries like the original Salam-Sezgin solution. And as I said before, you can see this from a probrain analysis. The extra gamma matrix projections are fully consistent with the original 8 supersymmetries. okay, now although the zero mode has remained unchanged, the full metric, of course, has changed. And if we demand L2 normalizability of the zero mode in the generalized metric, we in fact require choosing C1 equals to zero in the harmonic function. And there's also the coefficient C2 in this sort of Noether-Schwarz fibrain generalization in the harmonic function times the log tanh. In order to avoid generating a singularity at finite rho, should take C2 less than zero. Okay, so we know a sign, and we've killed off the C1 coefficient. In that case, if you notice that minus log tanh and the original Salam-Sezgin functions sech to rho have the same asymptotic behavior at large rho. It goes like e to the minus 2 rho. That means that this distinction between scattering and bound states, or candidate bound states and scattering wave functions, is exactly the same as in the original system. That's why I showed it to you, in fact, because it's easier to talk about before I put all this Noether-Schwarz fibrain stuff into it. When you go out towards infinity, it looks exactly like the Salam-Sezgin problem. So what about the non-zero modes? Well, this, in fact, becomes a Morsen-Feshbach-type problem. We're basically into one-dimensional quantum mechanics of a certain sort with what's called energy-dependent potential. So we haven't quite finished the analysis of this, but you can see what's going to happen. Anybody who's done square-well-type problems in quantum mechanics knows that when you have a nice eigenmode, which satisfies your boundary conditions at zero and at the other end, in this case infinity, for a given eigenvalue, and then let's hold one of the boundary conditions fixed. Let's hold the one at zero at the origin fixed. So it's going to have to be just the pure log tanh solution there, nothing, no constant. And increase the eigenvalue lambda. What happens is a node comes in from infinity. Crossing of the wave function comes in from infinity. And then the wave function dives off. It does not hit zero. It dives off to infinity. It becomes non-normalizable. This is the general problem of sequences of wave functions, eventually until you increase the eigenvalue enough so that another node can just appear at infinity and you keep on accumulating node after node after node. Node number increases as the eigenvalue is increased. So you get this discretization of the eigenspectrum. What we can say at least is that for small lambda, as soon as you start changing it, you're going to destroy the boundary condition at infinity, the L2 normalizability condition. So the zero eigenmode is going to be isolated. And that's all I can really say here today, that there's going to be a mass gap above the zero eigenmode until eventually you reach the scattering states, the edge of the scattering spectrum. Now, whether there's another bound state in there or not is a question one can ask. There are indications that, in fact, there may be only one, only the zero-mode bound state, and then a mass gap until, basically, the potential equals one limit, and then the scattering states begin. So this is the part that we haven't completely worked out, but you can see that there is a mass gap. And that is the key issue for localizing gravity near this surface. Okay, I'm coming to the end here. Let me just tell you a few things about what life looks like in the lower dimensional surface. If you reduce down to four dimensions, so two, you basically have the transverse four dimensions I've talked about. You have six dimensions on the Neuwirth-Schwarz five-brain world volume. Of those six dimensions, two are naturally compact anyway, what I call the psi coordinate and another coordinate called chi. So if we reduce on those, we end up with a four-dimensional theory where the fluctuations and the appropriate normalizations are going to look like this. We have the Newton's constant in 10 dimensions, the volume of the five compact dimensions, and then we have the rho integral here. This is what normally gives rise to a vanishing Newton's constant in the lower dimension. But here, we have to do the appropriate integral for our wave function, dH/dH. One can work in a gauge-fixed fashion where the h mu nu fluctuations away from the flat four-dimensional metric are traceless and transverse, okay, just to simplify the writing of the gravitational action. So we have dH/dH with these constraints, d mu h mu nu equals 0 and trace h equals 0. Xi xi, because of course it still has to have the transverse part of the wave function in there. And what we want is this integral with this measure better be normalizable. Now, if xi is a conventional constant Kaluza-Klein transverse wave function, this integral diverges, and consequently the Newton's constant in four dimensions vanishes. That's a standard problem of these non-compact reductions. That another third aspect of standard non-compact reductions is Newton's constant vanishes in the lower dimension. Here, what we get, because our integral of xi is non-zero, we actually get a following nice finite result for the four-dimensional Newton's constant. Again, it's a feature of the natural concentration or localization of gravity on the lower dimensional solution. You insert the xi naught zero mode that I've told you about, log tangent rho, you find a finite result just proportional to V5 with the coefficients that I'm not giving you. Okay, so here I've come to my conclusions. Brain world supergravity on a subsurface of the Salama-Sezgin hyperbolic space, you can make a successful localization in a genuinely infinite transverse space. Now, this in contrast to the ordinary situation with asymptotically maximally symmetric spacetimes where localization has failed. The inclusion of the five brain now deforms the Salama-Sezgin solution, but it preserves all eight supersymmetries. And fluctuations around this background preserve the transverse zero mode, giving rise to massless gravity in four dimensions. And this mode also arises naturally from the field equation that includes the five brain source on the right-hand side. Non-zero modes, with at least I can say for small lambda, either fail to obey the conditions required at the origin by the Neuwirth-Schwarz five-brain, for example, by including this constant part that's illegal when you look at the field equations, including the source on the right-hand side, or they fail at infinity. Choose one of the two devils, right, is the problem of these non-zero modes. If you impose the boundary conditions at zero and integrate out, it will fail the boundary conditions at infinity. If you impose the boundary conditions at infinity and integrate in, it'll fail the boundary conditions at zero. This is a typical problem of moving slightly away from an eigenfunction in eigenvalue. So there's a mass gap between the zero mode and the edge of the continuous mass spectrum, and gravity is localized on the lower dimensional world volume. Initially six dimensions, but two of those are naturally compact anyway, so you arrive at a four-dimensional localized gravity. So that's basically the story I wanted to tell you about how we've, I think, by using only legitimate toys of the string and supergravity toy chest, arrived at a localization of gravity in a lower dimensional space-time. Of course, this is not put forward as a consistent truncation in the mathematical sense that Gary Gibbons loves, for example, right? This is an approximation. So There will be corrections to the four-dimensional gravity coming from the Kaluza-Klein massive spectrum. Above the mass gap, there are this continuum of states, and those are going to provide corrections to gravity in four dimensions when you get to suitably small distances. For long distance, basically the corrections are, of course, sort of Yukawa structure. So when you go far enough away from, far enough away in distance I mean in the four-dimensional space, you have two mass points in four-dimensional space interacting through basically gravitational field lines that are spreading a little bit out into the extra dimensions, but not very much because it's largely concentrated to the space. When they're far enough away, essentially the whole gravitational force is concentrated in the four-dimensional subspace. When they're close together, then the field lines can spread out more into the extra dimensions, and you start to get these Yukawa corrections. And this is a standard feature of brain world localization attempts, that in small enough distances, you will start to see corrections. And of course, this is also what's interesting to the SLED people, because they want to actually put the two dimensions of the two sphere that I mentioned, they want to make it pretty large. They actually want to make it on the order of a tenth of a micron. Now, I don't know how much that, I'm sorry I didn't get to talk to Cliff Burgess here today, because I'm not sure what tune they're singing after the Bicep 2 results. But in any case, in terms of phenomenology, these models actually put forward possibilities of quite large extra dimensions. And that would be the scale on which you'd start to see these Yukawa corrections, right? So as a scheme for cosmology and gravitational phenomenology, I think this is a framework that's worth playing with to see what it does. What we've been doing here is really just trying to build explicit supergravity constructions that have these features of localization. And until now, I think one could say there was really no model that did it just using legitimate pieces of the supergravity toolkit. Well, we have one now. So thanks for your attention.
So what was the dispersion relation for your graviton, for the zero mode?
By dispersion relation, let's see.
Like forming equals some function of k, could you specify the function?
I can't give you an answer right on the spot, but...
But it was like forming equals k plus some corrections, or... I mean, you expect to have massless gravity, right? So
yes, right.
Forming equals k, but I just wanted...
What we have is that corresponds to a zero eigenmode of this, eigenvalue of this Kaluza-Klein part of the operator, right?
Yes.
The total 10-dimensional field equations require is an h mu nu times a certain transverse part. We're looking at the zero eigenvalue part of that transverse part. Okay, and that satisfies the 10-dimensional equations and is naturally localized by putting this brain structure.
Yeah, but you should be able to extract the Fourier momentum.
Well,
the
linearized gravity here is just massless gravity in four dimensions. You can start to ask questions about what happens when you put in the trilinear couplings in h mu nu and so forth, and that's more than we've looked at. But just this is just massless gravity at this level of approximation. Your question, does it involve the effects of the higher dimensions? Yeah, because
right.
So in position space, it's Yukawa terms.
Mm-hmm.
E to the minus mr integral over m of e to the minus mr over r, integrated, of course, over the continuous spectrum, which is whatever that function is, probably Bessel functions coming back into your life.
So that's going to affect the massive modes.
That's the massive modes, but the point is that there's a mass gap between zero and the
right.
edge of the massless of the mass of the continuous spectrum.
Okay. Yeah. We're going to
talk. Yeah.
Alex, it's probably a question of terminology. So if I have a warp throat, and naively my warp throat can be infinitely large, but if I measure the volume of it, including the warp factor, the transverse integral happened to be finite. So from this perspective, I would say that I still have a normal warped compactification. Now, from your perspective, you're also finding that the four-dimensional Newton's constant is finite.
Yes.
So would that be sort of in this language to say that even though the volume, even though it looks like it's infinite size, but the actual physical volume of the transverse space is finite?
No. the proper distance out on the throat in the underlying space-time is still infinite. What happens is that this fluctuation mode on top, basically you have an underlying space-time with the eta mu nu in the four-dimensional piece,
right,
plus h mu nu times the xi, right? It's in the fluctuation that you see this normalizable wave function.
Okay,
the distance in the underlying space-time is still infinite.
So you're saying that it is only the massless mode of the Laplacian,
yes,
sees a finite volume.
Absolutely, yes.
And the other ones, that's why you were referring to as possible corrections. It's not a non-linear, in, let's say, you were saying not what would Gary Gibbon call a real truncation.
Right. We're not making a truncation here. No,
right, okay.
This is still the 10-dimensional theory. It's
right,
just
so
behaving
just,
like.
It's just zero mode looks like. It's,
absolutely, yeah. So this okay. isn't. Yeah, of course, in Cambridge they like to study consistent truncations because it's mathematically fun, right? But and this is not in that family. This is a reduction with a mass gap. So it's still our solutions of the 10-dimensional theory, but they behave like solutions of the 4-dimensional theory for appropriate scales.
It's a question about the standard Kaluza-Klein part you're left over with. Is there something...
The underlying space, yeah?
The two-dimensional compact space.
Oh, okay.
Is there something that stabilizes the radius?
Okay, so actually I referred to that a little bit in the beginning of the talk. We have use for those dimensions, by the way, because I started with Salam Sezgin, which is a six-dimensional theory, which is the way this whole thing works, right? Now, coming down from six... first of all, we'd like to, actually, we come from 10 to 7, first of all. So one of these compact dimensions, first, one of these compact dimensions, first of all, is a natural compact piece of the H22 space. It basically has a U1 cross U1 isometry. There are two circles in it, one of which is of never shrinks to zero. The other circle is the circle around the tip of the Cuban cigar that you guys can buy up here in Canada, right? That goes down to zero radius as you approach the tip of the Iguchi Hansen, right? But then there's another circle, the other U1, which is naturally compact. It has a kind of toroidal structure. So that other circle, which we call psi, is naturally compact, so reduce on it, okay? There's one more direction to talk about, which is what we call y. Okay, that basically we viewed as the 7 to 6 reduction. Now, in what I originally said was Svetich, Gibbons, and Pope just did a S1 over Z2 reduction to get the chiral theory in 6 dimension out of that because they were trying to reproduce Salam Sezgin. Instead of just truncating that way, it's actually more useful to what we did in this other paper with Ergun Sezgin and my student, Tom Pugh, is do a Harjava-Witten there and actually get the chiral theory out as another compactification. It's compactification on the line interval, S1 over Z2. It naturally gives you chiral theories on the six-dimensional sandwich brains. And that's an earlier story I didn't want to get involved in here for reasons of time. But I have a use for that dimension, right? It's actually very nice to give you chiral theories in 6, and then you can reduce to chiral theories in 4. So not only do you get a compactification to 4 dimensions, you get chiral theories with n=1 supersymmetry in 4 dimensions out of this. Make of that what you want, but it's, you know, of some phenomenological interest. Indeed, this is another part of the, you know, Cliff and Fernando's attempts to try to make sense of lower dimensional physics from this point of view, starts with the Salam-Sezgin model precisely for these reasons. So those extra 2 dimensions that I talked about, merely I didn't want to talk about the detail here for reasons of time, but actually they're very interesting.